lives of five great Baroque composers.
I have heard all your Baroque shows, Bach!
Lots of kids!
Lully!
If he is not careful, he's going to have an accident. Oh. Isn't that Paul on the ground so near his tootsies?
We should be so lucky.
Purcell!
Purcell!
Oh, whatever.
His Dido and Aeneas was particularly well regarded.
It's what?
It's an opera.
The Baroque through the eyes and ears of some of Britain's top comic talents. Beastly Baroque, part of Baroque Spring on Radio 3. Weekdays next week at 5:30 in In Tune and throughout the day on Red Nose Day, this Friday the 15th of March.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Election Commission in Kenya has declared Uhuru Kenyatta the winner of the presidential election. Mr. Kenyatta avoided the need for a runoff by the narrowest of margins, gaining 50.07% of the vote. However, his rival, Raila Odinga, has already claimed that there were voting irregularities and is expected to challenge the result. Mr. Kenyatta is due to face trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague in connection with the violence that followed Kenya's last presidential election in 2007. Violent protests have broken out in Egypt after a court acquitted seven police officials who were on trial for their role in a football riot in Port Said last year. Two former security chiefs were sentenced to 15 years in jail. The court upheld the death sentences of 21 people accused of taking part in the stadium riot in which more than 70 people died. Police are continuing to search a house in northwest London following the arrest of the radical preacher Abu Qatada. He's alleged to have breached his bail conditions. Three other properties have already been searched. Abu Qatada, who is wanted on terrorism charges in Jordan, is due to appear at the Court of Appeal on Monday, where ministers will try to overturn a decision allowing him to stay in the UK. The Business Secretary, Vince Cable, has questioned the Chancellor's strategy for cutting the deficit. He's called for more emphasis on tax rises rather than spending reductions and suggested that some government departments should no longer be protected from cuts. Suicide bombers have carried out two attacks in Afghanistan. In the capital, Kabul, nine people died in an explosion outside the Defence Ministry. In the eastern province of Khost, an attack on a military base left eight children and a policeman dead. In Rome, a temporary chimney is being installed at the Sistine Chapel in preparation for next week's conclave to elect a new pope. White smoke from burnt ballot papers will indicate to the outside world that the next pope has been chosen. And the weather, rain in central areas will edge south, turning to sleet or snow in places. It'll be drier and clearer to the north, but windy and cold. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one. And now today's early music show, which is joining in with Radio 3's Baroque spring season.
This weekend, we're focusing on two composers who you could say were both linchpins of the French Baroque. But in terms of their lives and their characters, they couldn't have been more different. One of them, Jean-Philippe Rameau, was by all accounts rather antisocial, reclusive even, especially towards the end of his life. Tall and painfully thin, some called him mean with his worn-out clothes and his almost obsessional interest in music. The other is Jean-Baptiste Lully, and what a contrast. Here we have a confident man enjoying all the rough and tumble of court life and simply brimming with ambition and hunger for power. Lully loved the limelight, not that it made him many friends. He may have collaborated with playwrights and hobnobbed with the great and the good of Parisian society, but he was an arch manipulator and not afraid to use or push aside anyone in his way to become the most celebrated composer of his age. Rameau and Lully did have one thing in common, though, in that each of them owed their success to the support of a powerful patron. And in both this weekend's early music shows, I'm going to be exploring those relationships. Tomorrow we'll look at Rameau and his patron, one of the richest men in France. But today it's Lully and his relationship with none other than the king himself, Louis XIV.
Thank you.
two dances from ballets by Lully. Air pour le vieillard et sa famille from the Ballet des Plaisirs. And before that, we heard the Chacun des Scaramouches from Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme. Both were performed there by Arcadia Baroque Ensemble, directed by Kevin Mallon. The tradition of dancing or ballet at the French court was enormously important, not just as an artistic expression, but as a way of demonstrating social status and power. So the king himself needed to be the most brilliant dancer of them all. Louis XIII had achieved this somewhat timidly, but his son was considered to be little less than magnificent. For Louis XIV, all forms of art had to be a manifestation of his own glory. And the man who enabled this to happen, and who for some 34 years worked closely with him, adapting and moulding the heroic image Louis wanted to convey to the world, was Jean-Baptiste Lully. In return, this court composer from humble beginnings, some said he was a miller's son, was to receive enormous privileges, wealth and status. But just how did this relationship start? Well, Lully was born Giovanni Battista Lully in Florence, his surname originally spelt with an I. It was said he learnt the violin from an old shoemaker monk. Then at the age of 10 or 11, he was taken to France by the Chevalier de Guise, whose niece wanted to practice her Italian. There he remained for the next 10 years, honing his skills on the guitar, the violin and as a dancer, and taking every opportunity to hear the very best in contemporary French music. And when Mademoiselle de Montpensier was exiled after the Fronde, Lully took his chance and made his way to the royal court. He'd been there just 2 months when La Ballet de la Nuit was staged at the Great Hall of the Petit Bourbon, adjacent to the Louvre. It was one of the many spectacular entertainments put on for the nobility. Some of them queued for 5 or 6 hours to see the performance. And the message they received was loud and clear. The scene portrayed the greatest day in the world. And Louis, just 14 years old, appeared before them dressed in gold as the rising sun, while spirits in voluminous costumes came to render him homage. And dancing alongside Louis was the young, talented and extremely ambitious Lully. It was the beginning of what would be an extraordinary ascent. Musica Antiqua Cologne, directed by Reinhard Goebel, with music from Ballet de la Nuit. It was given in February 1653, and less than a month later, Lully was appointed composer of instrumental music to the king. It might seem odd that a young composer of Italian birth should engage so closely with the court that was so concerned about portraying France as the leader of the civilised world. But for many years, it was another Italian who was the most powerful figure in government. Cardinal Mazarin had been the chief advisor until Lully was old enough to take the reins of kingship. He ran what was seen as an Italian clique, introducing Italian composers, Italian players and Italian operas into France for both political and artistic purposes. And it was through him that Lully's career now reached the turning point that would bring him to the attention of the French public. In the wake of the Thirty Years' War, Mazarin drew up a peace treaty between France and Spain, which would be concluded, signed and sealed, if you like, by the marriage of Louis XIV to the Spanish Princess Maria Theresa. That summer, for one incredible year, the court undertook a wedding trip, travelling through France. In every town and village, there were musical entertainments as the crowds formed to catch a glimpse of their glorious ruler and his bride. And Lully and his orchestra, the Petit Violon, also had a hand in the proceedings, performing his very first religious composition, the Motet de la Paix, or the Peace Motet, on the court's triumphal return. "It is good through and through," declared Mazarin, obviously delighted with his countryman's work. "Baptiste is a rare and gentle enchanter." The opening of Lully's Jubilate Deo, Le Coeur du Marais and La Symphonie du Marais, directed by Ugo Renne. When Cardinal Mazarin died, France had, in effect, lost its champion of Italian music, and Lully was shrewd enough to realise that he now needed to confirm his loyalty to the French establishment once and for all and become a naturalised citizen. He also found himself a French wife, and the marriage contract certainly reveals just how far he'd come. Not only is it signed by some of the leading figures in the French government, but by the King and Queen themselves. And no wonder, because just 8 days earlier, Lully had been awarded the highest office of all for any musician, Director of Music for the King's Private Quarters. Lully also realised that he now needed to create and promote a recognisably French style of music. Having already assimilated the long tradition of French dances, he now introduced many new ones into the court ballets. Out went the old courants and galliards, and in came fashionable bourrées and minuets. And to complement the great dancing, singing spectaculars, he also produced intimate chamber music, including songs in which he now set not Italian, but French lyrics. If love subjugates you to its inhuman laws, choose as the object of your love someone full of charm.
Thank you.
Si l'amour vous soumet, an aria from Lully's music for the play Le Mariage Forcé of 1664. Guillaumet Laurent with Capriccio Stravagante, directed by Skip Sempe. Lully's music was now becoming more and more well-known outside Paris. This was also the beginning of the most brilliant period of Louis XIV's reign, a great flowering of the arts and literature in which Lully collaborated with some of the most important dramatists in the land, such as Molière. And he played a full part in all the great celebratory occasions that marked the course of the Sun King's life. There was no stopping him now. And in 1672, he pulled off a trick that must have had his colleagues spluttering into their teacups. For some years, the poet-librettist Pierre Perrin had had the royal permission or privilege to run all the opera academies in the realm. But he wasn't a good businessman, and when he ran into trouble and was jailed for debts, Lully leapt in, purchased the privilege himself, and managed to persuade the king to agree that now only he, Lully, had the right to run what would henceforth be known as the Académie Royale de Musique. What's more, he managed to get a royal order that forbade anyone else to organise a performance of a sung piece without his permission, on pain of a huge fine and confiscation of the theatre and all the equipment. Lully speedily fitted out his new theatre premises, an old indoor tennis court it was, and opened with a pastiche of old favourites. But the next show was an entirely new work, Cadmus and Hermione. It was so successful that Louis XIV came to see it in person, which was just as well because, as always, Lully had made sure it would flatter his royal patron. And in the prologue, the king was represented as the powerful Apollo, fearlessly slaying the Python of Delphi. Here's the overture. London Oboe Band, directed by Paul Goodwin, with the overture to Cadmus and Hermione, Lully's first tragédie en lyrique, premiered in 1673. For the next 10 years or so, Lully revelled in the support of his patron Louis XIV. He was given permission to take over the Palais Royal Theatre, and at every opportunity he flattered the king to gain yet more special privileges. "You yourself, sire, have even condescended to make the choice," he wrote to Louis when the king had selected a particular opera libretto for him, "and it reflects the heroic deeds and wonderful qualities of your majesty." Certainly Lully knew how to be obsequious to the king, but things could be rather different when it came to his colleagues. His manners were rough and his temper could be violent. He was known to have broken violins over the backs of players. He wouldn't allow for any singer with a cold, and he set out fines for each hour of rehearsal time that was missed. And most shockingly, it was even said that he kicked pregnant actresses in the stomach to make them abort. The backlash started when Lully's opera Alceste was savagely attacked by a cabal. Even a visit from Louis XIV couldn't soften the ill effects, and another work, Isis, gave rise to another scandal when Lully's enemies claimed they could see Louis XIV and his mistresses portrayed in the principal characters. They identified Jupiter as the king, the jealous Juno as Madame de Montespan, and the beautiful nymph Io, they said, was a thinly disguised Marie-Elizabeth de Loutre, Louis's current mistress.
Passant d'autres climats.
Oh, quelle peine!
Oh, quelle peine!
scene of Lully's Isis, first given in 1677. Sophie Damon and Paul Agnew were the soloists with Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. As you can imagine, the idea that he and his mistress were being parodied in the work, even if it wasn't intended, did not go down well with Louis XIV. Add to that the rumours that Lully was having an affair with his page, a murder threat, and a shady incident of extortion, and you get one displeased king. However, Lully led a charmed life, and despite all the court intrigues, he was appointed conseiller secrétaire du roi, much to the displeasure of the other secretaries, who took offence at the arrival of an ex-scullion in their ranks. And soon he was also to have a second protector at court, the Dauphin, who requested Lully's Le Triomphe de la Mort to be given at his own wedding. Of course, the king, now in his 43rd year, had long hung up his dancing shoes, but the performance was still very much a family affair, with the ballet created around the Dauphin's bride, Marianne of Bavaria, who was an excellent dancer. The Dauphin himself would also take part, and at his side danced his young siblings, including Mademoiselle de Nantes, just 9 years old, in the role of youth.
Thank you.
Chœur et la Symphonie du Marais, directed by Hugo Rennes, with Chacun pour les Mêmes from Lully's Le Triomphe de l'Amour, given in 1681. Lully was not 50 years old, but was already at the peak of his career. And yet gradually, his relationship with his royal patron began to falter. Louis XIV was feeling his age, and under the influence of his devout partner, Madame de Maintenon, was becoming more and more preoccupied with religion. Increasingly, there was a sense that opera was immoral. It was attacked by the clergy as corrupt, and, someone remarked, the court took on the demeanour of a convent. Lully, as you might expect, was well ahead of the game, and now he began to compose religious music. But ironically, it was a performance of his Te Deum in a service to celebrate the king's recovery from an operation that was to be Lully's downfall. Conducting with his usual energy, waving around the traditional long-cane baton, he hit his toe with its sharp-pointed end. Gangrene set in. He refused to have his toe amputated, put his affairs in order, and 2 months later died of his injury. Lully and Louis had grown and matured in unison. A shared ballet performance had brought them together all those years ago, and in a way it was almost predictable that another performance in honour of the king would end Lully's life. Such a man would rarely be seen again, and despite his, shall we say, challenging personality, Lully was remembered with enormous respect. The Prince of French Musicians, they called him, the inventor of beautiful and grand French music, which he brought to the peak of perfection.
Thank you. Misericordia tua, Domine, semper nos, quem ad monam speravimus in te. Quem ad monam speravimus in te. Quem ad monam
Dignare Domine from the Te Deum by Lully. Le Concert Spirituel were conducted by Hervé Niquet. And it ends today's early music show, which was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Sam Phillips. And Lucy will be back tomorrow with more music from the French Baroque as she explores the relationship between Rameau and his patron, Alexandre le Riche de la Pouplinière. That's at the same time, just after the 1 o'clock news.
Folk songs have been with us forever, but these days you're as likely to hear them in a concert hall as out in the fields and towns where they began. If you want to get a sense today of the earthy power of this music, I think you can't do any better than hear them sung by a choir. I'm Mary King, and in Radio 3's The Choir this week, I want to share with you some of my favourite choral works inspired by traditional folk music. From the airs and dances of Eastern Europe to the ancient melodies of the British Isles, I'll be exploring how composers like Janáček, Kodály, Holst and Vaughan Williams created masterpieces from the stories, songs and soil of their native lands. That's The Choir with me, Mary King, tomorrow at 5 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now we have Saturday Classics. And looking ahead to his 70th birthday celebrations in April, this week's guest presenter is the distinguished conductor Sir John Eliot Gardiner, who introduces us to a selection of music of special personal significance.
It's hardly Christmas time at the moment, but I'd like to start this collection of recordings that mean a lot to me with a piece that I first heard when I was 6 years old, because it formed part of a nativity play which I took part in. My mother was the director of it, and it was all local school kids. It was done in a barn and with beautiful music, and O Magnum Mysterium of William Byrd is an iconic piece, and it's engraved in my imagination, because at this point the Virgin and Joseph walked in with the baby to the stable, and this magical music of Byrd was an accompaniment to the mime.